dedicated to HBO's Game of Thrones and George R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire book series. You're listening to Podcast Winterfell.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Podcast Winterfell. This is Mike, and I am here with Tracy and Donald, and we are the Later in the Week crew, the people who watch the things a few times, the folks who've read the books. So here we are. We're going to talk about the episode this week, a little bit more of a deep dive into some of the scenes. I think we're just going to kind of go scene by scene and see how that works out. How are you guys doing?
Doing great.
Wonderful.
You work overnight now, right, Donald? So
that's correct.
Do you ever like dig graves with the hound in back of your bar, or
that would be better than some of the stuff I see in there?
All right. Well, it is. What is it? Wednesday night now. So, have you watched the episode more than once? Have you had a chance to do a rewatch, Tracy?
Yeah, I watched it. One and a half times premiere night, and then one and a half times today. So that there
okay.
we go.
How about you, Donald? Have you done a rewatch?
What is a half time?
getting distracted and tired.
Oh, okay.
And saying, okay, I know I'm going to go back to this, so let me just worry about this other stuff.
Okay, I got you. I've watched it one and a full time.
Okay, good. One and a full. Excellent. So before we get deep into it, I mean, is this what you think? People are talking about it like it's kind of a warm up or a prelude or whatever, just a check in with everybody. Certain things got a little bit deeper than that. A lot of people are talking about pace. How did you feel about it as an opener, Donald?
I agree with some of that. I felt like this was an episode that had to be done. It was more of a get the ball rolling type of thing. At first, on my first watch, I was a little bit disappointed at the pacing. It did move significantly faster than previous season's openers or previous season episodes. But whenever it ended, I got the feeling like, man, nothing really happened. I was ready for bang, 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 crazy, mind-blowing stuff to happen. But you can't always get that. It kind of reminds me a little bit of how I felt back in the old days when we were watching the last season of Lost, and at the end of every episode, I was just disappointed because I wanted more stuff to happen. And while I was doing that, I was missing stuff that was actually happening, pretty important stuff. And there's a little bit of setup in here, too, for a few things that I think is going to come into play later on. But, I mean, I didn't have a problem with it on the second watch, and I was able to pay more attention. And, the expectations are always higher, and you get disappointed, but I feel like, in the end, I feel like this was a really strong opener, probably one of the stronger ones that we've had, and it laid a lot of the foundation for some crazy things, hopefully, that are to come.
How about you, Tracy?
I have to say that I thought it was a really good opener as well. There were a few, dialogue things that I thought were a little weird, but as far as plot and placing, I think that they're right on target for kind of moving a little quicker than usual, but again, like Donald said, nothing too mind-blowing except maybe that opener, if you want to argue that. But a definite strong start. I really feel optimistic about the rest of the season.
All right. That's a good thing to hear. All right, Donald, we're going to talk. Let's start off talking about Arya, the beginning of the show. We have literally gotten a specific request for your reflections on the Arya scene. So we got to give them what they want, right? I mean, everybody's waiting for you, Donald. So, here's your turn to disappoint. What'd you think of the Arya scene?
I'm going to be brutally honest. I kind of hated it.
All right. That's probably what they wanted, if we're being honest.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's reacting to it, on the outside. Yeah, it's really cool, but the logistics of it is what bothers me, and it's the same as last year.
God, you're a fucking logistics person. All right,
it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. How was she able to do all that and infiltrate? I don't know, but even if you put that aside, I felt like that was a really, and this is going to sound like completely opposite of what I just said, but I felt like that scene was really rushed. And we don't need a big setup, a year-long setup for that. I get it. But I felt like that was a really, really rushed scene. It almost felt unearned, that we finally got some justice for the Starks, and then it's like, oh, hey, everybody, drink some soda, or you're dead, bye. And I was like, all right, that's it? I mean, is that the end of the phrase? It's like, how did, I don't know. So what are the ramifications of that? Is we're probably never going to see anything having to do with that again, honestly. That's the way I feel. So that leads to a lot of my disappointment, not to mention the fact that how can she just cut off random faces and now without, I don't know, it doesn't make sense. Like, are we going to see that all year? Is that
what
everything?
What the hell else did you want out of the damn Frey storyline except for them all to die? I don't understand
that's
what
fine.
Else you wanted out of that.
The end result is fine. I just felt like, oh, that seems like the exact same thing that happened last year, except she just killed more people. So
right.
Yeah,
the argument about, you know, it being, like, when you think about it as revenge for the Red Wedding, it seems a little glossed over. As, like, the opening Arya scene in the Prelude episode, it's sweet. You know, so it's one of those, like, I first saw it as that opening Prelude thing and didn't really think about it as the revenge scene we've been waiting for since season 3. It does seem a little gloss from that perspective. What about you, Tracy? What did you think of Arya?
I kind of looked at that scene as fan service-y. I think most fans really like Arya despite how murderous and monstrous she's kind of becoming. And that was to get the cheers going. You know, I think that was to kind of get everybody's blood pumping. If that were buried in the middle of the episode, it might not have hit the same way. I have to not think about the logistics because the whole thing was like, you know, you put the face on, so now you also talk like the person. You have the same body type as the person. You know their mannerisms. You can say what I used to do and how I used to be. You know, it's a little bit of a reach, and I almost feel like that's why the House of Black and White stuff was so light last season, because they didn't want to write themselves into a corner, you know, and say, here are the rules, this is exactly how this works, and then when Arya leaves, they can't do anything because she doesn't have this powder or that drink or whatever, and so now they can kind of just say, it just works, it just does, that's it.
But did you have those problems when it was Jaqen? Or did they come to fruition when you got kind of more detail in the little world and so on and so forth?
I mean, with Jaqen, you're right. Like, you kind of just accepted everything that he did. But I guess because we didn't see his transformation. So as far as we know, he's a master at this.
And also
for
with
her. Oh, go ahead.
No, with Jaqen, we didn't really see him become anybody that we had already seen. So it was just like, maybe he's just inventing these people.
Ah.
Didn't even think about that. Yeah.
It's a little more fantastic that way, whereas this like makes it a little more real when she becomes Walder Frey, for Christ's sakes.
Yeah, she's like Mystique or somebody, you know? Like, she can just freaking... And my friend was asking me, she goes, so does the person whose face she takes, do they have to be dead? Or is she manually removing a face? And then does she have some sort of magic that allows it? Or can she just go ahead and change? So, and I'm assuming they have to be dead. Because otherwise, I feel like she would have been doing more things. I don't know. That's just...
I assumed from the House of Black and White sequences that they have to be dead. Because, I mean... Like, if you peel my face off, please kill me shortly thereafter if you didn't kill me before. I don't think I really want to be alive anymore. So I had assumed that, yeah, that was really one of the only rules. That's a good way to put it. I hadn't really thought about it that way, but you used that word a moment ago. And I think that's a great way to say it. That's one of the only rules that I think we've really been privy to. And as you mentioned, even that's, I guess, not totally specific.
And I mean, we can kind of talk light book stuff here, right? So
yes. Just I haven't said it before, but as far as the way Podcast Winterfell breaks up, the three of us have read the books, and Tim and Heath and Axel have like bullshitted like they were going to read bits and pieces, but they don't remember any of it. And I don't know that they really read it to begin with. I think they might have just been signaling on Twitter or something. I don't know, but. So, you know, at this point, and this is a conversation I think it would be fun to have at some point, not to break right this second, but, you know, I think we can talk about some book stuff, because anything we can garner from the books at this point is so wild speculation, I feel like. That I don't really think it's going off the rails. So that's my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just like with the faces, if I remember correctly, didn't Arya's face get cut when they were putting a face on her? And it was very like visceral. Yes. And, you know, so I was sort of hoping for something like that in the show. And I was a little bummed that they made it so sort of like easy peasy. Like, we don't really see. And there's no cost to magic, which is kind of like a theme that runs through this, you know, where it's sort of like, oh, that person's dead. I'm just going to grab that face, put it in my bag, and I'm going to go.
Yeah, that's a good point. In the books, it didn't seem like they were actually peeling her face. It more seemed like they were kind of like making like a hole to tuck it into or something.
Yeah, like, it was.
Right? Like, I know that's weird, but it's like they were making a space to tuck the outer face into your normal face. And then that way, like, the outside face could kind of meld with the under face a little better. That's an excellent point. And there is no hint of that, of the cost to that magic in the show so far.
Yeah, and Arya, I remember she would remember some, you know, bad thing. Like, I think one of the faces that she put on, the woman was, like, abused or something, and she was, like, feeling the fear and the sadness, and it was kind of touching. So you kind of are invested sort of in this face and in this person that she's becoming. So I thought that was, you know, really nice, and that's just not here, so it feels a little thin sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just peel the back off, stick on, and then continue. Go kill.
Yeah. It's like a Richard Nixon mask in that Patrick Swayze movie, right? There's also, you know, another interesting element from the book is that if you remember do you remember how she like the moment before she got her eyesight back in the book? You remember she's in the House of Black and White, and there's a cat. You remember that?
Yes.
And the way I recall it, she could see through the cat's eyes, right? And that was when Jochen gave her sight back, was when he realized that she was essentially warging into this cat to be able to tell him what he was doing, or whatever, to be able to tell what was going on. And that is another element that I don't think has been present in the show, but made so much sense for there to be another Stark who was a warg, right? Like, I found that, like, super excited. I was really excited about that. And that was one thing that I was disappointed about, is when she comes out of the whole sight thing and the cat was nowhere to be found. Because, like, I feel like that's one of those things that you could... It wouldn't be that complicated to exhibit in the show, you know? So I wonder, do you think that her kind of warg elements are going to come up at any point? It seems like that would be extremely useful for a person on a murderous rampage.
It would, but my thing is, it's so late in the story now. What catalyst do we have for that? Like, what can bring it out of her at this point?
Because if it just happens, maybe if she sees Nymeria, fingers crossed.
Oh, right, because Bran was warging into his dog.
Yes, I mean, right? That's the only way it would make sense. Other than that, I mean, what other connection to an animal does she have? There really isn't one. So if it's anything other than Nymeria, I wouldn't buy it.
That's an interesting point. And the cat in the House in Black and White, it wasn't really presented. It was presented as like something that she did out of desperation. You know, like almost like maybe she didn't know she had that ability before. But when she was blinded, you know, it was kind of a solution that she came to out of desperation. And so if it were going to come up again, you would think it would be in kind of a stress or pressure situation. Yeah. Right on. Do we want to say anything else about this? I mean, there was some part of you that had just enjoyed the pure revenge of murdering all these morons, though, right? Right.
Yeah, and I mean, her closing lines are pretty strong, and I think, you know, you can kind of get behind the whole the North remembers, and, you know, that's great. I mean, pump us up, get us ready for the theme. I think it was smart placement for sure.
I agree, totally.
All right, so scene two was the White Walker March, which I thought was really interesting, because in our pre-show, and before the season, Axel, I think his, like, first shot prediction was a bunch of snow, like rising up like dust, you know, because all these dead things are marching through it. And I'm sitting here listening to him, and I didn't say anything. But what I'm thinking is, like, that's really dumb, because, like, snow doesn't do that. It's wet and heavy. Right? But, like, I'm not going to interrupt the podcast to, like, teach Axel about the physics of water, you know? Like, that's completely ridiculous, right? And then he was right. They did it, you know? And I'm looking at it. I tell this story to my wife, who grew up, she was skiing from the minute that she could stand. Her father put her in skis. And she pointed out to me that good skiing happens on powder, right? Like, that's totally possible, you know? So here I am busting myself out, even though I didn't do it in the moment. For me, the standout of that scene really was obviously the Giants. I mean, that was the thing we had never seen before, right? Was a white giant.
For sure. That was
a giant
freaky.
White. How do you say that?
Yeah.
Giant white sounds a little racist, but I don't know.
More racist than white giant.
I don't know. I guess they both have their racist tendencies too. Oh. One thing I did like about that scene, it kind of made more sense with that scene that we saw in season two where they're all marching. So now we know that they're marching towards the edge of the wall. So it makes a little more sense why they haven't gotten there yet, and they're just picking up whatever they can on the way.
So is that real time or is that the future? That the first time I watched it, I assumed it was real time. And then when I watched it today, I was wondering, was Bran sort of looking ahead? What do you guys think?
Ooh,
good question.
Better be real time. We got to get this shit moving, man.
Yeah. Because the Hound also mentioned that he saw it too. So what would be the chance of both looking at the same point in the future?
That's an interesting question, though. I don't think it's clear. Yeah.
Right. Way, I guess he has the ability to do both. So we'll find out.
There was some talk in some of the pre-shows about like dead animals that have been brought back, like maybe like dire wolf whites and stuff like that. Have we seen any indication of anything like that, or is that pure fantasy at this point? Because I was looking in the crowd, you know, I was looking for woolly mammoths or something, you know, like give me something I didn't know was going to be here, but I feel like I didn't see anything.
No, we've just seen the horses in the past, right? And then that's it. But, you know, everybody wants the ice spiders, biggest hounds.
Do you want the ice spiders?
That would be so cool. but you know, but that's season 8. Like, that's not this season. No, that's next season.
Yeah, I think the fact that we saw the horses kind of proves that we could get animals. But other than that, I don't think we have actually seen any.
Right. Well, I hope they bring some extinct ones, like seriously, like mastodons and stuff. I like, we don't got to go like full dinosaurs, you know, but even I would even be okay with like a giant aardvark, you know, something like, yeah, let's just get weirder and weirder, man. All right. So then Bran gets to the wall, and you guys have heard all the talk about Bran having the mark because he couldn't control himself and hung out too long, right? And was touched by the Night's King. So everybody's heard these ideas about, you know, once Bran crosses the wall, does that kill the magic? We saw him cross the wall. We didn't see any indication of it affecting the magic. So I am just, like, utterly confused at this point by, there's so many different theories around that whole thing that I just get lost in the soup. So you guys are going to have to take this one. Did Bran just fuck everything up?
I mean, I think that the mark just means they can locate him, right? Or, but the wall, like, I don't think that he changes the wall.
Well, this is one of the more popular theories, is that once the mark crosses the wall, which to get to Castle Black, he has to go all the way across the wall, right? That in some way nullifies or reduces the power of the magic in the wall. You don't sound like you buy that theory.
I mean, okay, so the reason why I would be super bummed about that is because I thought the mark was just BS anyway, that it was like a throwaway line out of nowhere. I was, my eyes were rolling for days. So if this mark that was a throwaway line becomes the reason that the White Walkers can just sort of, you know, amble on into the gift or whatever, like, I just can't. I would be a little disappointed.
That's just weak sauce for you. Weak tea.
Oh, come on, man. Wouldn't you think the Raven would have led with that if this is the severity of being touched?
I feel like the Raven left a lot of shit out. I mean, to be completely honest, I feel like, you know, Seedow just couldn't talk fast enough for the job. I don't know. What do you think, Donald? Is everything ruined now? It makes sense if Brandon Stark, Bran the Builder, built the wall for Brandon Stark, Bran the Destroyer to tear it all down, right? I mean, that's at least a closed loop.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, what this is based off of is the cavern or the cave from last year where they couldn't enter until, you know, Bran came in. So people assume that it was the same kind of magic that kept them out of the wall, which I think it might be a little bit stronger. And what I think, honestly, I think they can now, or the dead at least, can now, you know, go past the wall, where before I don't think they had the physical ability, as we saw, like, with the bones from the cave, where they just fell apart because the magic that was animating them didn't work once you crossed that threshold. So there's a lot of talk about that as soon as he crossed the wall would collapse or something like that, but I think it's just an unseen magic that now doesn't apply anymore. And we wouldn't really see any indication of that until they got there, I guess.
But isn't there some indication that the magic is not just keeping them out, but also keeping this big, physically impossible, heavy thing up? Or is it just like, you know, the 10-year winters? It just doesn't, our math just doesn't count.
Yeah, there you go with that logistics again. I mean, we could talk about the giant bridge of ice that's, you know, blocking, but I don't think that they're going that far into the world of magic as they did in the books, where even when we saw Sam cross, whereas in the books, I think it was like a face that, you know, kind of opened up and let him in. Where we saw it in the show, he was just kind of a door that he just walked through.
Right. So you don't sound scared.
I don't sound, no, not really, because I think they're just going to attack that castle. And, you know, whatever happens, where even if, like, a chunk of the wall kind of falls, or, you know, a giant white Tyrannosaurus comes and headbutts the wall. I mean, who knows?
So you think they're just, the battle's going to be at Eastwatch, and they're going to basically just flank it?
Yeah, I think that's where the ultimate battle will be at. Maybe, like, episode 6 or something like that. I think that's where it's all going to happen, and that's going to be the big end battle. I mean, we've seen just regular people scale the wall. I mean, who knows what we've seen those little, what do you call them? The little whites. We've seen them walk on the ceiling, so maybe they can just run up the wall. I mean, there's endless possibilities.
Yeah, I'm curious to see if we're going to see those little skeleton-y, like, fast-running things that look like those old stop-motion movies.
Yeah.
Nice. Exactly.
You know?
Like the frame rate was off or something, like they sped up.
Yeah, those were a little weird. I hope that's it for them. Like, I hope maybe they were just around the cave or something. I don't know. I'd much rather see this.
They were like Spider-Man. They were running on the walls and on the ceiling. And, I mean, they had, you know, rules didn't seem to apply to them. So maybe they could just run right up the wall.
Oh my God, this is going to be terrible. What do you think Bran is going to, I mean, do you think Bran is going to spend any time at Castle Black, or do you think he's going to move straight to Winterfell? What do you think is going to go down with him this season?
That's an interesting question. Here's my thing about Bran. I don't really care about him that much. Honestly, he could be anywhere. I don't really care. Well, I'm not going to say I don't care about him. I don't care where he is. Physically, he can be anywhere. It's kind of stupid lugging him around in like a wheelbarrow and stuff like that. Physically, I think he can be anywhere. What's more important is the things that he sees and how he can relay that information to the people that we need to know it.
So, like, okay, right. So his actual, like, location is less important. Now he's basically just safe. He can just kind of hole up by a tree somebody can feed him jerky and put water in his mouth. And he just becomes like our expositionary tool.
Yeah, I mean, he's just like a server.
That's fine. That's okay with me. I can live with that. Anything else on the brand? Go ahead.
Does Mira have any purpose at this point? I mean, do we think that the fact that she's a Reed matters in the show?
I mean, I am attracted to the idea that Howland Reed is a source of information that doesn't require, you know, Bran to roll his eyes up in his head. I like that idea that Howland Reed can solve some of these problems straight away. Mm-hmm. And so she would obviously be a way to, you know, convince him to take it seriously.
Yeah.
I would like to see that, you know, if not this season, the last one, that'll be, you know, like a real gift. I think the book readers are kind of salivating, like we all kind of feel like in the back of our mind that this guy is freaking important, and all the theories about how Howland Reed's this character and that character, like we need something.
And I, you know, I don't necessarily need him to be any of those characters. I just, you know, he's like kind of such a central key to Ned. And, you know, people always talked about Ned and Robert and their relationship. You know, but I feel like even though it's less celebrated, you have every bit as many mentions of Ned and Howland in the books, you know, and the importance of their relationship. And in fact, once Robert's rebellion is over, you know, Ned goes back north, right? And isn't really in Robert's daily life in the same way. And so I feel like, you know, we're not only talking about R plus L equals J and, you know, their time together then. Not only the information that Howland can provide around R plus L equals J, but also then after Robert's rebellion, when, you know, Ned is Warden of the North, and I assume he's kind of having a little more interaction with Howland than he is with Robert, and certainly he's having more interaction with Howland than Robert is with Howland. So I think, you know, that could be something really fruitful. And, you know, I don't necessarily know. It would have been neat to have some indication of him through these episodes, you know, throughout the show more than we have, but I don't know that it's necessary. You know, I think you need like one more scene of him and young Ned. And then, you know, you just do a little crossfade to his feet. And you're like, right. Here we are, right? Like,
well, this is the show. I mean, it makes me wonder if he did show up, how many people that have been just watching the show would even care or remember who he is. When we've seen in the past where they like to consolidate things, and why have a guy telling people stuff that Bran can just tell us?
Good point. I mean, Mira would have to say, this is my father. He spent time with your father.
But not necessarily. I mean, yeah, okay. Yeah, there's probably going to have to be at least one terrible line. But like, but I felt like the scene, the whole scene at the tower was really powerful, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that especially if you've been watching this whole time, you're kind of thirsty for a little Ned, you know, a little young Ned. So I think people would be paying attention. I don't know. Pure speculation. Enough Howland, goddamn Reed. all right, so the next scene was the whole John and Sansa thing, and it was fine, but I'm not really that excited about it, and it kind of went along lines everyone expected. And the best thing that came out of it to me is the idea of the little Mormont girl finding achieving, what's the right word for it, coming into her womanhood. And Brienne is the only one there to explain to her what's happening. That's what I really want. That's the only thing I took out of Sansa and Jon, which is of no value whatsoever. So did you guys enjoy Sansa and Jon? Does anybody want to talk about that?
I mean, I feel like there's been some, you know, Sansa gets a lot of flack for kind of like not doing anything and not being proactive, or, you know, so I feel like I was happy to see her making a decision, you know, even if it didn't carry the day. She kind of spoke up when she felt like her voice needed to be heard. So that was encouraging for sure. I liked that, but I did see a lot of the opposite opinion kind of floating around after the episode. You know, let John lead, don't question him, and all of this stuff. So, I mean, how did you guys kind of take it?
That's all bullshit. She said the right thing. She made the point. Like, nobody could question Joff. Like, you know, you really are going to get a shitty attitude with me? Like, nobody could question Joffrey. That's what makes us different. I felt like her answer was sufficient.
Yeah, I was proud of her. I don't know. I mean, I felt like she could, but I guess on this call, we're kind of respecting at least what she had to say. I mean, her point of view was pretty much how things are done normally. I mean, John is the one who, you know, called an audible, if you really want to talk about it. So he's the one who needs to clear things up ahead of time, if anything.
Yeah, I just have a problem with like the not even the way she brought it up, just where. And like you said, John, maybe he didn't talk it over with her. Maybe he felt that he didn't need to. And maybe the only thing that came from that is the fact that he's now a little bit more accepting that that debate, whether you're right or wrong, debate is always a good thing. It's better to hear more than one perspective. That way you have going through it stronger and you can make the right choice. But even more important than all of that, the thing that I got from that that I liked the most was Sansa kind of implying that she learned a lot from Cersei. So I think that, that's probably a little more hint of the direction and you know and that things are going for her character at least, which may or may not be the best thing. Because I even think that what she said, let's talk about logistics again. Logistically speaking, the rebuttal that she had to John's decision in the middle of a war, I don't know, trying to take houses away and move people around probably isn't the best thing to do at that point. Maybe something to talk about later on. Or maybe, you know, just giving them the people that did help you out, maybe giving them a higher position or, you know, like a west wing of the castle or something like that. But I think moving a lot of people right then and there probably wouldn't be the best thing to do. And the best thing to do right now would be to focus on the war, which I think is what John is pretty good at. So I dig that. That's the only thing I would have from that. But her speaking up and wanting to have a say in things is fine. I thought that was an area of growth for her character. And she really felt that she was right. And she stood up for herself even after it was over with. So I thought that was pretty good. But seeing Littlefinger enjoy the kind of, you know, the battle between them two is also kind of troubling to me because a lot of people have shrugged him off lately because he's just been kind of standing against that wall for 9 months right now. But I still think he has a few things up his sleeve.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, well, that scene happened later, right? But if you want, we can kind of talk about just all of Winterfell.
I've just been following this lineup on Hollywood Reporter. So if the order's fucked up, email them. Go ahead.
Okay. No. I'm saying like the continuation. I feel like she talks to Littlefinger like later in the episode, but it's all related to what happened. And like where she tells him to like, you don't need the last word and all of that. And she kind of, you know, shuts him down a little bit. And I kind of feel like he's letting her do that because he's just biding his time. Like, I in no way feel that Sansa has the upper hand, at least not yet when it comes to him. I don't know. I think you're right. People are underestimating him because he's being quiet, but he's no fool. Like, this guy's always playing chess and she's just learning. I don't know. I'm a little worried for
her. Well, she thinks her problem right now is that she thinks that because he wants to get sleep with her, that she has the control over him. Which I don't think she does, like to your point. So no. she might be like screwing herself in the long run.
And do you guys think that's really what he wants? Because I feel like he just wants power. And if that comes through Sansa, he'll take it. If it comes through someone else, he'll take it there. Like, I don't think it's all about her.
Yeah, I don't know if I buy the obsession angle either. And I think that, you know, another thing that everybody's talking about, including literally her in the show, is, you know, Cersei's needs allies, right? And so the idea that he could end up going back and, you know, kind of just giving a big donation to the Bank of Lannister and being right back in their hands seems to me totally possible, you know, and that would be, oh man, that would make the internet upset. which I would be okay with. You know, that was the thing. Like, I didn't have a problem with anything that happened in the scene or you know, the way that Sansa kind of spoke. I mean, it just, like, that to me seemed like the most kind of pro forma scene, you know, just check in, least information gathered kind of scene in the whole episode. It was fine. I didn't have a problem with it or with her or anything that happened kind of within it. It just was like, you would expect this to be where they're all going to be. So of course that just leads to the question of like, how is that whole thing going to get torn down and ripped up? And how is that all going to get turned into a mess? Cause every time something seems to be clicking along like you expect it to, it never ends up that way.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things that I talked about in the beginning where you think nothing's really happening, but I think they laid down a lot of foundation, you know, with the Littlefinger and his smirks. And then, more importantly, Sansa saying that she like kind of learned some stuff from Cersei. I think those are the little subtle things that we have to watch for, like that might come into play later on in the season.
Well, that was one thing that I kind of took more from their conversation in front of everybody, more than like really it being about her asserting power. It was about, you know, her talking about the philosophy of power in the South versus him talking about the philosophy of power in the North. And, you know, so it made sense that he's, you know, the king in the North, you know, and the blah, 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 all that stuff. Right. So he's going to, you know, swing the sword. Right. I mean, if he gives the if he says you got to get your head cut off, he's going to be the one who does it. But so the question is going to be like, what does he have to learn from Southern style, right? From the Southern politics style. And presumably there's something. And she made that point, you know, like they're both dead because they didn't learn whatever this thing is. So let's figure it out together. So it seemed to me like much less aggressive and much less annoying than it seemed to feel to other people. I don't know.
Hey, Solo, we just interrupted the podcast to talk about Patreon.
Oh, man, we interrupted the podcast, but it's for a good cause, Axel, right?
It is. Patreon, baby. Join us. Become a patron. Join the club. We got this DVR podcast network right now. We're doing Podcast Winterfell. We're going to continue Podcast Winterfell after the Game of Thrones season is over. But we're also going to take on new podcasts. We want to do a weekly podcast where we're talking about TV. There's a bunch of shows out there.
I would love to continue on the film list. I used to do top 100s, favorite films and stuff like that. But I would love to do more countdown. There's so many other things. Maybe revisit old shows and do maybe like a three-part podcast on a series we like. I'd like to talk about The Wire, Axel.
Oh,
like,
The Shield. The Shield. I'd love to talk about The Shield. Yeah. Go to Patreon /DVR. And now back to the show.
All right, let's talk about Cersei, who's really enjoyably insane. Euron seems like he's just made to die. Yeah. I've enjoyed, right? There's been a lot of people talking about, you know, how Euron's going to end up some form of a zombie. And I'm super attracted to that idea. He's got like those stupid, like, you know, chops on his face that like, that's some good zombie shit, right? It gets patchy. And also, you know, I'm just kind of more than anything else fascinated by the relationship between her and Jaime and the way that Jaime, you know, has been a calming influence on her, kind of. I mean, not ultimately, it wasn't successful, right? He just blew everybody up, you know, but I think he did kind of forestall that action. You know, you saw them in the last season going together into the small council rooms and trying to have an influence without just murdering everybody. So I'm kind of curious what effect you think he's going to have on her, if he's going to have any effect on her, if it's too late for him to have an effect on her. And ultimately, which of them is going to kill each other? Because I don't really see how else that relationship ends. Tracy, what do you think?
I think we're finally going to sort of get that book relationship. Because, I mean, I think where we leave those two is him writing Cersei off. If I remember, he's in, like, the Riverlands, mm-hmm. right? And he won't respond to her. And in the show, they kept pushing them closer together. And I'm thinking, like, why are they doing this? I don't understand. they're supposed to have like a wedge between them at this point. So I think this was my first hint that they might be moving towards him basically realizing that he can't reason with her and she's too far gone for him. And if Euron,
which is where he's at in the books. But again, in the book, it's, there's not any book. We don't know what the result of him feeling that
right,
way is.
Right, right.
You know?
Well, I think what you just said before, you know, one of them dying at the hands of the other or being the reason, I think that's where it's headed.
What did you start to say about Euron? Sorry.
Oh, like if he gets any headway with her, I mean, he can, there's no way he can handle another husband. Like he can't handle that. He's way too fragile. I mean, right. This guy made like two little digs and he was so wounded. So, I mean, he can't handle it. No. I wonder
what
if
do you think,
Bronn.
Is there going to be a marriage in there? Oh God, I love Bronn, man. Give me Bronn. I hope we see some Bronn. What do you think, Donald? Do you think we're going to see a Euron Cersei nuptial?
I personally don't want to see that. I have no interest in seeing that. I think that you guys are writing off Euron a little too soon, because I felt like that scene, he made a really strong impact, not just on Cersei and of course Jaime in a negative way, but I think he made a strong impact on the show, and he pretty much made a promise. No one's talking about what that promise is. What is he going to come back with? You know,
what is it?
He had a lot of chemistry too.
Like, yes.
I kind of liked it. I'm not going to lie. I never cared much for him, the actor, or anything that he's done in the show before. But just the kind of swagger he had about him, where he's stepping up on the stairs, not afraid. Definitely, he left a mark. So I think he's going to be a player this season.
What's the gift?
I think he's going to kill that girl who killed Marcella. What's her name?
Sand snake or all the sand snakes?
Well, it wasn't really the sand snake that killed him. It was the paramour.
Ilaria.
He might be going to Dorne. I don't know. He's still got all those ships. Did anybody else think that was like super overkill, bringing all those ships just for like a 5 minute?
Oh my God.
Logistics.
Yeah. And look, they were gorgeous, right? Mm-hmm. Like they were gorgeous ships. But why did they have to go so over the top, right? I mean, they could have just had like a cool, simple ship with a cool sail and we would have been fine. You know what I mean? But no, it has to I think they said it on initial reaction. Like it looked like a house on a boat. It looked like sighting.
No, but that was because he told them to go tear their houses down because they don't have any, right? And that's why they had to make all those boats, because they don't have anywhere to live anymore on their actual Iron Island. So they just brought everybody on the boats.
Oh, my God. So basically the Iron Islands are just these floating ships now at this point?
Yeah.
If they all sail to Dorne, the Iron Islands are in the south, and then like when they come back up,
Yep.
Oh, that's right. Man.
Well, they're not going to come back up though. You know, the dragons are going to kill them all. This is like absolute ethnic cleansing for the Iron Islands. I think the ultimate fate of the Ironborn is that Theon is like the last one standing, and he's got no reproduce. So,
Waka Waka! Yeah.
I will just see Arya take Euron's face and hand them all grape juice, and they'll all die in like 5 seconds.
I like that idea of him coming back with one of the Dornish women, because like other people are saying that he's going to bring her a dragon and shit, and I'm like, oh, you don't want him to make it to episode 3. What are you talking about? I like the idea of one of the Dornish women. That seems to me much more reasonable.
Yeah, at first I was thinking, could it be a horn? But they didn't introduce any of his, you know, his forays into other cultures and things in the show. So I kind of bailed on that idea pretty quickly.
Right. He made a couple of comments about it, like as part of his like campaign speech. Right at the King's Moot, but he really didn't get into any details, and there was nothing to indicate we should take it seriously.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's a good point. All right, well, this is good. Cersei's not mourning. And what do you think about Heath's idea that Jaime's going to push her out a window? I am just like, I love this idea so much. I can't get over it. I don't know about the timing. I like his timing, you know, episode one, season eight, all that kind of stuff. But in the way we've been talking about it, kind of the human war is this year and the, you know, the big battle is next year. And so it kind of makes sense for her dying to be climactic, blah, blah, blah. I don't, but really, I don't care about the timing. If the next, if episode two opens with Jaime pushing her out a window.
For no reason, just...
that would be amazing. What do you think of that plan, Tracy? Go ahead, Don. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I got excited because Heath has been saying that for years, and I love it. Like, I always, every time he says it, I just crack up. I love it. And we, like what you guys were saying, maybe a wedding, maybe he walks in on them having sex, and he just, you know, pushes him out the window, and it would be like a replay of, you know, Bran catching them two having sex, and then he gets pushed out.
But how poetic. But I mean, shouldn't Jaime go out the damn window? I still haven't forgiven him for Bran. I don't care.
I'm right there with you. Right there with you.
I mean, this guy is just off the hook because he's handsome and he's nice to Brienne.
Right? And he's always forgiven.
Well, yeah, and this is, you know, I think this is, and I said this before, so I'll keep it brief, but I think Jaime's got a like day where coming where he just loses his shit. And, you know, we're all kind of reminded of the Jaime we didn't like, you know, and then whatever, he either dies or pays some penance or, you know, but he's got to remind us. It just seems to me untenable that we're just going to keep going with this, like, you know, whatever, happy-go-lucky, like Greenwich, Connecticut, Jaime. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Right. He's so reasonable, right? He's so logical. Cersei, stop and think. No, come on. I mean, look, this guy was so rash. Do you, I mean, if we go back to season one, right, him confronting Ned was a huge problem. When Ned says, like, oh, you know, Catelyn captured Tyrion on my command, and Jaime just draws, right? Like, where did that person go?
And I, you know, I recall there being kind of references, and maybe I just completely made them up in my own head, but I recalled there being references at one point to Joffrey's kind of reactionary attitude basically coming from Jaime, you know, but just being like turned up, you know, like that next level, right? But you kind of saw Jaime doing those things in season one and then Joff doing them in season two. And I had always kind of connected those things, but it's been so long now, I can't remember if I just made that up.
I guess you could draw that from that. It does make sense.
So I just made that up? Okay, well, so we'll move on from things I just made up then. Let's talk about the Hound. I am loving the Hound. I'm loving the philosophy. I'm loving, you know, him searching. I hope that the answer he comes to is not some form of religion, especially not Melisandre's religion, which I would find super annoying. But I'm enjoying him kind of going through the process. Donald, what did you think of the Hound this week?
Well, I mean, this is a guy who knows exactly what he is, and he's not afraid of it. He knows he's an asshole. He knows he's a killer. But he also, he has like a sort of an unspoken code that he lives by. He does care to a certain extent. He cares. He just knows. Like you said, I thought this was the perfect line for this episode, where it's like, why, Dondarrion was like, why are you, you know, such an asshole all the time? And he was like, experience. You know, he's been through enough to see how the world is, how people are. He can still live within those parameters of that, but also be his own person, which I love the dude. Like, he's one of my favorite characters on the show since, I think it was, what, season five, where he and Arya went on the little walkabout or whatever they went throughout the Riverlands or wherever. So I thought seeing him look into that fire, and to me, that did kind of scare me. Like, I'm the same boat as you, because that sort of takes him into another realm of you know, religion or magic, whatever the hell it is. But seeing his face, sort of like a realization in him that, you know, maybe he doesn't know the world as much as he thought he was. And scared that that's going to change him a little bit.
Mm. Yeah, he's very world weary. Mm-hmm. Like somebody who knows everything, you know.
Yeah, kind of jaded, and that's what kind of makes him what he is. But what direction is this going to take him now, seeing that there's like another way or there's something else beyond what he's seen and what's weathered him down to the point that he is now?
What do you think, Tracy? Is he going to become a priest of the Lord of Light? Is he going to get red robes and shit?
No way. I can't see it. But I mean, I don't feel that someone like him can do anything other than face the threat from the north, right? After seeing something like that. I feel like he's the type of character that understands responsibility. And even though he's not an affectionate person, he's also not a selfish or irresponsible person. He might call himself selfish, but he's not. And I'm guessing that this is going to, for sure, push him north and, you know, maybe by Sansa again, which I would love to see.
So you're saying he's not a selfish person based on what? The Sansa almost getting raped scene, maybe?
Yeah, well, just in the sense that, like, when he sees something as being truly wrong, oh, I guess not the butcher's boy. That would be not, well, that's not an example. But like,
you said, he was still under the command of the king. Or the
right.
First.
But, like, you know, I think you're right. During the bread riots, he made sure that Sansa was okay when other people are like, oh, she's out there. Uh-oh. And he's like, come on now, and, like, goes out there. I just feel like deep in him, he's not this full monster. It's just he'll call people out as much as possible, and, you know, that rubs people the wrong way, and he's physically imposing, and he knows that his looks turn people off, and I think he resents that a bit, so he's super gruff and, like, overcompensates. But deep down, I think, you know, if something is truly wrong on like a fundamental or moral level, like he's going to respond.
Even when his brother was going to straight up kill Loras, he stepped in. We didn't really have to.
Oh yeah, for sure. Right. He had nothing to do with that.
And you could go back to him last year where he kind of beat up the guy and took his silver. And, you know, I think he takes advantage of situations that he knows are doomed. But, you know, he needed the silver. He's like, the guy isn't going to use it. He's going to be dead. You know, he just as soon just kill him and get it over with. Sort of a mercy. So he can operate within the parameters of being an asshole without actually being an asshole. Like I said, he has a code, sort of an unspoken code, where he'll do the right thing, but it's almost like it's hard to explain. The guy's really complex.
It's amazing how many people you can murder on this show. And if you have like a half an episode of introspection, people want to forgive you. People just want to be like, you know what? That guy and his silver and his kid, look, he feels bad about it now. Look how bad he feels.
Okay. Would the Hound have stolen the silver from a mother and daughter?
I don't think he would have.
He wouldn't have. No way. I think because it was a man, he felt like, look, if I can beat him up, then I can take this silver. But I'm not going to hit a woman, especially knows, like in those times.
And he knows situations that he has no control over. Like he couldn't save those people. Like there's no way. So he knew they were dead. And he was right. I mean, we saw it this year. He was right. They weren't going to make it through the winter.
But buy blankets and like chickens with the silver.
That's a
space
heater prophecy for sure.
I'm not saying I would have done it. He's still an asshole, but he operates under a code that he feels is right, and it's just I don't know. It's complex. It's the only way I could put it.
Well, and even if you have a code, you know. You violate it sometimes. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't matter what your code is. It's impossible. Not even if your code is to be a dick all the time. Sometimes you hold the door for somebody, right? So like, I feel like you can have a code even if there are counterexamples. You sound like you want to say something, Tracy. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh no. I was saying that his whole thing about the family's not going to make it through the winter was really a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, it's like, oh, they're going to die, so I can take the money. And now that they don't have the money, they die. So he's like, see? But, like, what if we had just left the money? Then we would know.
You are not going to eat that. See, I just ate it. I told you you weren't going to eat it. What did I tell you? Oh, my God. Well, I've been really impressed with the actor throughout. I mean, it's hard to portray melancholy in so many ways. I don't know how else to say it. He's got melancholy rage. He's got melancholy, like, calm. He's got, you know what I mean? He just, and it's all got that same kind of thing. And it was really interesting to see him kind of play that moment in the fire. Did you want them to give you a little bit of what he was seeing, or were you okay with just like a picture of sticks on sticks burning, I think is what he said at first?
I'm fine with the way they did it. I don't think
Go ahead, Donald. I'm sorry.
I don't think we needed to see it, because then that would take away from the sort of acting and the reveal of watching his face see it.
Just living it through him.
Yeah. It's like if you're reading the books and then all of a sudden they just put a big picture of whatever somebody's describing, it kind of kills your own mental image of it.
I feel like we would be talking about how bad the CGI was.
Right. Well, you know, this is one thing that they don't seem to portray a lot of. I don't know. I don't know the right way to say this. There are elements of magic that they don't seem to portray. Right? Like, in the book, Melisandre's necklace always lights up. Mm-hmm. Right? Her jewel. Especially when she's, like, talking that good shit, you know, or doing a spell or whatever. You know, her jewel starts to light up, right? And they haven't done that. And I expected in the scene when she took it off, and you see her age dramatically, I kind of expected them to stick it in there, you know, because with all the CGI they're doing, it wouldn't be hard to make that dumb little stone light up, right? Like, it's not a question of, like, technical competency. It's a decision to not do that, you know? And it seems like they're kind of, you know, not showing the vision in the fire is kind of the same choice. I hadn't thought about it in terms of experiencing it through the actor. I think that's a really excellent point, and I think he lived up to it, you know.
Yeah, like, I believed him when he said he saw something, for sure. There was no doubt in my mind. I mean, now what that all means, I don't know. And that, I think that scene left me the most puzzled, because I'm thinking to myself, like, the Hound is so agnostic, you know, like, what is this going to change his character in some way? But I don't know. I mean, I really still want the sort of, like, angry / sad guy that we're used to, even if he has a mission.
Mm-hmm. Do you think he's going to join the Brotherhood?
He's not a joiner. I don't know.
More of a, you know, kind of tag along. I don't think he's going to join it any more than he is now, where he's just kind of with them. And he'll see, like, maybe it's my purpose to fight along.
Okay, I don't know if you've ever done acid before, but the first time you do acid, you remember the people who were there, right? Like, there's some weird bonding moment that happens in that thing, and maybe they don't even feel it, right? But you feel it forever. It never goes away, you know? And I wonder if there's, like, some sort of, you know, a bonding thing that happened between the fire vision and the grave digging, where it kind of seems like to me, like, you know, Dondarrion is the titular leader, right, of the Brotherhood. But it kind of seems like Thoros is the one who really is. I mean, Thoros is the one who's bringing him back to life, right? So, like, I mean, yeah, sure, Beric is the man and everything, but without Thoros, I feel like the whole thing falls apart, you know?
For sure.
And so, So I feel like even if he just has a relationship with Thoros, it's still going to look an awful lot like joining the Brotherhood. You know, even if he's busting Dondarrion's balls or whatever, it's still, you know, if he's participating in their actions or whatever you want to call it, you know, if he's participating in whatever they're doing, then he is kind of, I mean, he's effectively joining, right?
Is that okay? I guess.
Does he need to be a solo runner, or is it okay if he...
It's more like, all right, we're together, but I'm not going to post it on Facebook, you know?
So it's complicated between the Hound and the Brotherhood?
Yeah, exactly.
Got it.
I can totally live with that. I can live with that designation. All right, this I'm looking at this Hollywood Reporter thing, and I'm realizing this thing is shit because it doesn't have Sam on it at all. So that's weird. I mean, surely they saw that part. I don't know if they paused it and passed out and forgot. But let's talk about Danny next, and then Sam, and then that's it, right? Am I missing anything? No, just Danny and Sam, right? Okay. So we're going to talk about Danny a little bit, and I'm going to make everybody deal with this magic in her eyes thing that I'm obsessed with. But first, let's just kind of get some general impressions. Dragonstone was super sweet, right? What'd you think, Tracy?
I love the location, right? That puts whatever they had Stannis doing to shame. The approach, the beach, I mean, everything looked amazing. So just from an aesthetic point of view, I really think Dragonstone was great. And then in terms of what it means, the choice to not have any dialogue till the very end was really powerful, in my opinion. And I think it was the right choice for sure. Because, you know, if they would have had Tyrion making some, like, quip or whatever, like, it would have just, I don't know, dampened the moment a little bit. So I like that they let her sort of drink everything in and just walk through it on her own and kind of go through it as like a person who's finally achieving what she's been trying to do for so long.
Matt was very emotional about it. Matt's
really,
you know, yeah, Matt's emotional, you know, in his reaction to these things. Right. Like, and by emotional, I mean like invested, you know what I mean? I don't mean like, I don't know what else I would mean, but like invested, you know, and seems to really kind of like feel these things, and talked about, that was part of the fan call in was Matt called in. I mean, super fan, right? Like obviously, and really talked about, you know, we've been waiting this whole show to see her get to Westeros, you know, and this was the moment, right? And he seemed to feel, you know, I don't know, like he seemed to feel really invested in it and like it was a really emotional moment. Whereas like I thought it was cool and I thought they gave it its due, but what I really got out of it was the end. You know, which I don't know why they keep getting me worked up. I keep getting excited every time she acts like something's gonna happen. They've been getting me with that for years. You know.
And then credits.
And then credits, you know. But it seems, I don't know. What did you think, Don?
I didn't really care that much about this scene. I felt like it was supposed to be a big moment, but the fact that she was met with no resistance, it just didn't do it for me. It looked great, which makes me think that they're going to spend a lot of time there before anything actually happens, because it looks like they spent a lot of money on that whole set piece.
Jamie said he left it empty, right? Stannis left it empty, which would suggest basically that everybody left and then they all got murdered at Winterfell. But it seems like he would have taken the army, but it's, you know, there would have been like some old people there that like, I don't make shoes or something. I don't know. Right. Like would everybody have been gone, or was there like still kind of a functioning city on the other side of the castle we just didn't see yet?
I'm hoping. It's just, you know, and even if there's no city or nothing else there, like just there's no resistance. And I want to know how far in advance did Jaime or Cersei know that that's where, because we saw the scene where he was like Dragonstone. So they right, had an idea. They had an idea she was coming, so and they didn't send anybody over there. So I don't know. It just, to me, that just, it took a lot of the wind out of what would have been a really emotional scene, because that's the first time she's come back. But
You were expecting Lannister resistance, not like the people of Dragonstone being like, who the fuck are you, right? Like, you're expecting the Lannisters to show up and
that
try to man
an old
that
guy
bridge.
Yeah, it could have been just an old guy there, and she's like, bend the knee or die. And they're like, well, who are you?
He like, throws a rock, Obama worm kills him, and then they move in. That would have been cool.
I don't know. I was hoping for more. Also, the scene where she's like kissing the ground or whatever, to me, if we had seen in season one something where she was already there and she was returning back, then it probably would have meant a little bit more to me than, you know, just her never having been there or anything. To her, it's just ground. It's not like, oh, I used to walk on these sandy beaches or anything, and now I return. It's just, hey, I'm here. I don't know.
But you don't think her talking about it for so long could kind of make up for that fact that she has no memory of being there?
Yeah, I mean, she could talk about it, but I mean, this isn't even where she ultimately wants to be. You know, I don't know.
Go ahead.
I just assume that she wants to be in, you know, in King's Landing or somewhere. I know that Dragonstone is where people are from, but she doesn't recognize any of that stuff. I don't know if she saw pictures of it or drew like art or whatever. I guess they didn't have cameras back then. I don't know. But then again, I could be overreacting because it was such a short scene and it could have just been played up for that emotion. And then next week, she'd be like walking through the halls and like, oh, this is what my grandfather told me. Or this is what that, and maybe. But I don't know.
This is one thing that, you know, living in New York, like I know a lot of people who didn't grow up here, right? Mm-hmm. People come from all over the world, you know. But also, you know, a lot of people whose parents came from literally everywhere else. And so they grew up in America, but, you know, in New York, but frequently English was not the language spoken in the home, you know, and they heard stories. Even, you know, sometimes some people, obviously stories differ with everybody. Some people went back more often than others. Some people never went to the country that their parents came from, but they heard about it their whole life, right? And when they go there, they have this magical experience, even though they've never been there before, right? And like that sand means nothing to them in terms of like their day-to-day experience, but there is a lore to it that has been built up through their whole life. There is a lore that has been built up to this place that their parents came from that is meaningful to them in a way, you know, that I just will never understand, you know, because like my family was so far removed from where they came from. And when they left, the place that they left and they came here, where they left was so terrible that they didn't talk about it. And they definitely didn't talk about it positively. Right. And so it's kind of, I found it really interesting, to be honest. And I really kind of believed it. But I think why I believed it is because there were a lot of kind of personal reflections that I was able to make, not to my own experiences, but to experiences other people have described. And they describe it very similar to that, you know, where they just want to walk around quietly and touch things. I have never experienced the spirituality of a rock, but a lot of people thought like, it's not, there's something real to it. Right. Whatever it comes from, whether they're putting it on, whatever, you know what I mean? Like to try to define it is not what this podcast is about, but there is something real to it, for the people who experience it. And I thought that, you know, I believed it kind of for that reason.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's fair.
Now I want to talk about her eyes. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead. No. I'm not going to forget about the damn eyes. You go ahead and say what you're going to say.
Well, no, I was going to ask if you guys read The Princess and the Queen.
No.
Oh, okay. So that's the Dangerous Women compilation book or anthology series that George edits. One was all about the Targ history, and so much of it refers back to Dragonstone because, you know, they had the Targaryens that lived in King's Landing, but then they had all the other ones were back at Dragonstone. So for me, I'm thinking about all of that history, and it's just, I guess that's me projecting onto them that Viserys probably passed down a lot of those stories to her. So she's bringing all of that with her.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was implying. It's like maybe next week we'll see something where she's like, oh, my brother told me about this or that or this. But I just saw her pick up some sand and she's like, oh, sand. Okay. I couldn't relate to that enough.
So, all right. Did you guys, I don't know if you heard my interview I did with Derek Beres. That came out at some point this week. I don't remember because
I think it came out today. I think I saw it come on my feed today.
I had the conversation, so I find it odd to listen to them afterwards, to be honest, after I've had them already. But we talked about this thing that I noticed in the Danny arrival touching the sand scene that literally everybody thinks I'm nuts, even though there's a picture. And I don't know if this is like a blue dress, gold dress thing, or what the hell is going on? But I put the picture, and you know, I'm gonna go on an Alex Jones conspiracy theory tweet storm about this when this podcast comes out. So the photos will be up on my Twitter, and I'm sure Podcast Winterfell will relink them and stuff. But I put it in the Skype feed right now for you guys to look at if you can see. There is this ring around her eyes that. There's this ring around her eye, right? Around the iris that looks to me like it's the same color as the kind of the ice blue that is the defining feature of the White Walker's eyes, right? And there's all these shots of her on the boat coming up to the beach, and she's very wide-eyed looking, right? And I've looked at this shit frame by frame. You can't tell me I'm totally nuts here. Even if I sound a little crazy, I won't believe it yet, right? She's totally wide-eyed on the boat, and if you look at it, her eyes are clear. They're white, and the iris and the pupil like an eyeball, right? Then she touches the sand, and she gets this ring of White Walker blue that bleeds into the white of the eye, right? And it's like they close up on her face. To me, it is super obvious. My wife, who I believe loves me, but she insists that this is a reflection in her eye, like in the actress's eye. Like this is a natural thing that they could not have affected, right? So they just didn't clean it up. You know, they just left it there. But that's a reflection of the sky and the water. Now, this assumes they actually went to some sort of a beach and shot, and this isn't just all in a soundstage in Edinburgh or whatever, right? Which I don't know about that. But I feel like this is a CGI'd element that indicates that there is magic and that the magic is in the ground, right? Is somehow within the terroir, the earth, you know, and that it is the increase of this magic that is why we have the White Walkers, we have the dragons, you know about this theory. This is an ongoing theory about the question of do they bring the magic or does the magic bring them and so on and so forth. But I'm assuming if she can ride a dragon that she has some of the magic and that this is the first time that we're seeing anything that indicates a link in the source between what allows her to ride dragons and what allows Benjen to still be half alive. Now, am I totally insane? Or just a little insane? How crackpot am I going here? Do you see this in the picture, or is this a blue dress?
All right, wait. What do I have to?
I put it in the chat for our little session here. So if you can see the chat, the photo's there. Donald just typed in the chat, so I think he can see it.
Yeah, I saw it.
But you're not. You just. You feel okay, sorry for me, so you're not going to comment because I sound like such an asshole. You just want to let it go.
A little bit. This is one of those things where I think if it was that important, then it would have been more prominent.
In the language of filmmaking, like that much of a close up on a face is intended to be prominent.
But wouldn't? So you think that she's a White Walker now?
No, I think the same thing that animates the White Walkers is what allows her to ride the dragons. That the source, the magic, is not good or bad. That magic animates, right? In the way that good people breathe air and bad people breathe air.
We've seen her ride dragons before. We haven't seen that ring in her eyes until now. So what significance would it show to show it now?
That it's increasing as she gets there. The closer she gets, the more magical she is.
So she can ride the dragon like better now?
Yeah, dude, they're going to start doing barrel rolls.
I'm just trying to understand, like, what do you think that means exactly? I don't know.
What do you think, Tracy? Have I lost my mind? Do I need to go apologize to my wife for talking about this every day since Sunday?
Yeah, so I feel like, did Axel say something about blue in the eye or Heath? I feel like one of them also saw this. I had no idea what they were talking about. At least I can see the picture. I'm kind of with your wife on this one. It doesn't look like that blue to me. It doesn't, like the White Walker blue. It looks sky blue. I don't know. It's really interesting. All right. I'm going to look at it again, but I'm not picking up what you're putting down, but...
All right. Well, you know what? If I'm the only one at this barbecue, but whatever, I'm a good cook, so I guess I'm just going to be the only one at this barbecue. All right, let's move on to Sam. I think we're going to try to wrap it up here pretty soon. We have been talking for a while now, and it's been lovely, but let's talk about Sam and give it a rest. What do you think? Tracy, Sam, libraries. You like libraries. You read books.
Love libraries.
Yeah.
You know.
You love Sam.
Sam's okay. So this was a little weird for me. The gross out factor, I'm not loving exactly. It went on a little long, I felt. You know, I got the humor of it, sure, but man, if there had just been another thing that they could have intercut in there besides the soup and the poop and the, that was a little not so great. And it's a little disappointing because I get that he's low on the totem pole in the Citadel, but like, I wanted to see some learning, right? I mean, isn't this a bit of a letdown? I don't know.
I find it interesting people complaining about that sequence. As an editor, I didn't particularly like the choice. It was well done, obviously, but I don't need that in this show. But it also didn't bother me like enough to bitch about it, you know. But it's interesting to me, people kind of like, basically your comment essentially is saying like, it was a little too effective for me. That's always a fun comment for an editor to hear. Did it bother you, Donald? The poop and soup opening, which is the only thing I'm going to call it from now on.
It didn't bother me, but I could have done without it. And I would have been fine. I think on the second watch, I just fast forward through it because I didn't want to have to look at it, you know?
Yeah, I guess the issue is why, like you're saying they did a good job of grossing us out, but like, why did they want to do that? I'm just not, I don't know. Like, I mean, sure, you know, success, but why? I mean,
do you want to know what I think? Or like,
what do you think?
My interpretation was essentially that it was a way to kind of really show Sam's dedication. Like, Sam gets to me, like, that's what basically everything since Sam, not really since Maester Aemon died, everything after that has really just been about, like, cementing Sam's dedication to John, and like really it goes John, The Mission, The Night's Watch. You know what I mean? Like to me, like and really Gilly goes before The Night's Watch, maybe before The Mission, not before John. Right. And that's kind of like the order of Sam's priorities, you know, and those priorities are so cemented that he will, you know, really erase any opportunity he will ever have of ever going back to his family home, which is very nice. Right. Like you'd think he'd like to at least retire there. I mean, good Lord, it was beautiful, you know. And all of this is just about his kind of dedication to the mission. And he's so dedicated to the mission that he will even do this thing that grosses everybody out. So that was the way I interpreted it anyway, as like a healthy reminder of where his head is at. And for that, I thought, you know, so that's why I think it didn't bother me. So anyway, that's my theory. But otherwise, I mean, it was well done, but pretty rote. You know, I mean, you kind of, you knew the mountain of dragon glass was there. You knew he was going to figure it out, right? Like, you knew all of that was going to happen. The thing that I'm kind of most excited about as far as that goes is to see him and Tyrion together, which I think is a pretty obvious outcome, right? Like, the only two people in the thing who read finally
get
to hang
out. Wow, I didn't even think about that. Yeah, I actually think that would be kind of good. But how does Sam, like, it seems like Sam was sending a raven to John. So is Sam going to just, like, bust out of there because he feels like he's not able to really do anything?
He doesn't need to be a damn maester. He just needs access to the maester's internet, right? Like,
yeah.
He needs his Nexus Lexus password, right? And that's all he really needs. And so I feel like if he gets that information, right, he sends the raven to John. Like, what is John going to do? Is he going to come from damn Winterfell, or is he just going to be like, great, go there now? Because wherever the hell Sam's going to go, you know, Dragonstone is going to be closer to him than it is to John. And it's going to be closer to him than the Wall or Winterfell or virtually anything else he could be assigned to do, right? Like, I'm not picturing the map right now, but as I recall, King's Landing is on the east side of Westeros. Old Town is what, like kind of southwest, right? And then Dragonstone is between Old Town and Dorne.
Yeah, I'm looking at the map right now. So Old Town is, yeah, way southwest. Very close to
Not
Dorne.
Like very close to Dorne, right. And then Dragonstone is above that, but not like even to the reach, you know. So it,
yeah,
you know, it,
yeah, yeah.
Like if we're gonna go back to logistics, this would not be a problem for Littlefinger's Hyperloop, you know, for Sam to end up at Dragonstone. And, you know, they find the cache. And then, because that's another thing, is that, you know, Dany has gotten to a place and then just putzed around for the rest of the season. I mean, this has happened over and over, right? So what really is going to happen at Dragonstone? Don't you think she's just basically going to wait there for Sam to show up?
I guess. I mean, I had... Oh, man.
No, it's depressing, but what am I missing?
Well, I guess we're going to have some Tyrion kind of talking about the politics of Westeros and trying to help her understand. So we'll get probably a bunch of that and them catching up with what's been going on and touching bases with their allies, I guess, maybe Olenna. And
there'll be some sort of contact with Cersei.
Yeah, I guess she'll be told to bend the knee, like Jon was.
Right.
That'll be fun. I can't wait for that one to get there.
Yeah, there's an old story from the Greek and Persian Wars where the Persians sent envoys to the Greeks, you know, and throughout history, envoys have traditionally been protected, you know, diplomats have traditionally been protected. Just because what good does it do you to, like, kill these two dudes? You know what I mean? It's not, like, if you're going to fight, you know. But the Persians sent these envoys asking for earth and water, and the Spartans threw them in a well. And was like, you can get your earth and water down there. Well, it, obviously it killed them, you know, so the Persians were upset about this. This was part of what they were fighting about. At least on paper, you know, they're going to fight anyway, right? But I can very easily see a I don't know. I mean, I would assume that Dany's version of throwing envoys down a well would be just to feed them to her dragons, but it seems like those people probably wouldn't get back. They better not send Kevin Lannister or something, because he is not going to make it back to King's Landing.
Kevin is ashes.
You know, one of them. There's got to be another Kevin.
K-E-V-Y-N.
There you go. How about you, Donald? Some salmon gilly for you?
I don't care about Gilly. I don't know what her purpose is at this point, other than kind of be a companion for Sam. I would hope that they would expand her character a little bit more. Really, I don't have that much time. I kind of wanted to talk about the picture of the dagger in the book that Sam was reading.
Talk to me.
I don't know if any of you guys saw it.
Yeah.
So like, what do we think? Is that another like subtle hint that that's going to come into play again? And it may maybe in a different way than it did in the books, because we kind of passed that.
Well, talk about that. I mean, like, how, you know, what do you think? Like, explain just a little bit about how it came into play in the book, and then how you think it would work out in the show.
Well, are we allowed to say whose dagger that was in the books?
Yeah. Hey, everybody, yeah. If you don't want to hear this, you know, fast forward 20 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, so we kind of got the impression, or the I guess the proof, that that was Joffrey that set that up. Now, at this point in the books, this is the point in the show, it's kind of too late for that to sort of be the same reveal. It wouldn't have any kind of impact on anything. And then we did see that Entertainment Weekly cover where Arya was holding that same dagger on the cover. Mm-hmm. So I'm just kind of wondering what the... like, what kind of reveal could we get? Or what's the significance of putting that in there?
Right, and it's, like, super hard to suggest that an Entertainment Weekly cover is canon, right? But at the same time, yeah, but I mean, it's also hard to imagine... Right, it's hard to imagine that Game of Thrones is micromanaging every aspect of this thing to the point that nobody knows what's going to happen, and yet somehow Arya just pops up with this thing, what, she took from shooting? Like, that just, right. That didn't happen.
Yeah.
So that's another, you know, that's an interesting point.
I'm just wondering if you guys had any theories or any thoughts, or is it just a throwaway? We just need a page for this book, and we just need a prop for her to hold. Here, grab this.
I thought it was just an Easter egg, you know, for people who are kind of eagle-eyed. I was actually sitting with it, because whoever kind of like put it on Twitter or whatever caught my attention, because it looked familiar in the show, and then I finally realized that's where it's from. But what would that mean? The fact that, would that just mean it's ancient? I mean, that book was written God knows when.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like Sam's eyes turned blue when he looked at the page, so there's nothing there.
All right. Last minute, Tracy, you got anything else you want to talk about? What did we leave out?
We've
been talking longer than the damn show was on, so surely we got most of it in.
I know. I just wish they would have explained how Gilly was there. I mean, were they in the Citadel, or did they have, like, I don't know. That kind of threw me off. Logistics, you know? But
yeah.
Right.
Other than that, I think I'm good. I think I talked about everything that was on my mind.
All right. Well, this has been Podcast Winterfell Deep Dive Edition. I hope it's felt deep to everyone who wanted to dive. not too spoilery, because, you know, we're past the books. So it's all just speculation and BS at this point anyway, right? So new episode next week. We are going to have another interview coming up. We are going to have a initial reaction on Sunday night. We're going to have the fan call-in on Monday, which is going to be hosted by DJ Tim Hines this week. It's going to be excellent. It's also going to be on New York, or East Coast time. New York's not the only city on the East Coast time. Sorry, it's going to be an East Coast time. And so, you know, because last week it was on West Coast time, and so it was a little late, I think, for a lot of people on the East Coast. But if you want to call in and tell us what you thought of the episode, we would love to hear it. Email Axel's going to tell you all that contact information. I'm terrible at that stuff. Enjoy the episode. It's coming up in a few days. We are right around the corner from episode 2, and I don't even know what it's called because I'm going to watch it anyway, so why would I find out? Spoiler-free, baby. Podcast Winterfell. Thank you, Donald. Thank you, Tracy. It's been great talking to you guys. Talk to you next week.
Ooh.
See you then. For sure.
Awesome. The recording has ended.
Thank you for listening to Podcast Winterfell. You can find the podcast at dvrpodcast.com. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/DVR. You can email the podcast, podcastwinterfell@gmail.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at WinterfellPod and on Facebook, Podcast Winterfell.